You're listening to Wake Up Tucson. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Let's go to Tate Watkins from our friends. He was part of a report from the Goldwater Institute and the Property and Environment Research Center. Now, that's a title, Property Environment Research. Look at you. Tate, good morning, sir. Welcome to Wake Up Tucson.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It is a little bit of a mouthful. We often go by PERC for short.
Even better.
But yeah, we're based in Bozeman, Montana, and we essentially research ways to use markets and property rights to try to solve environmental problems, come up with conservation solutions. And so, as you mentioned, partnered with Goldwater on a recent report looking at water issues in Arizona.
What's your cool title over there? That's what I want to know first before we get going.
We're kind of a small team, our full-time team, so we wear different hats. But my title is Research Fellow and Managing Editor. So I'm wearing my editor hat, working on stuff that comes through our pipeline. So
next year, you're going to be Senior Research Fellow. That's what I'm going to tell you.
Let's hope so. Fingers crossed.
Your pay is not changing, but you're going to be senior, okay?
Oh, now you tell me. Okay.
All right. So, talking about delivering better water conservation does not require a dramatic expansion of the role of government. So that's our teaser theme here. So walk us through the report.
Yeah. So I mean, we kind of thought of two general strategies the way we kind of went about this report. Two ways to approach water issues. You know, you can think about doing things that would allow you to do more with less, or do more with, say, the amount of water that you currently have, or pursue strategies that would actually increase the supply of water, you know, get you more water into a system. And so, you know, I think either of those can be valid and valuable depending on things like local context, you know, cost, timing, all those things. But one we really focused on was ways that essentially markets can allow you to do more with what you currently have. And so, you know, reforms that allow markets to work better, just provide more flexibility, give people ways to adapt to changing conditions. A lot of the times we think of things like the government would do an appropriate role that most people would agree would be things like kind of setting the rules of the game, if you will. So a big part of that, you know, for what we are talking about is property rights. So making sure property rights are clear and enforceable and ideally tradable in ways that would allow people flexibility, again, to adapt to changing conditions. And so that's something that we focused on a lot with, you know, water specifically, obviously, in this report.
So give us the specifics on how this market-driven way of doing this would help in the real idea of water conservation in the West.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, you've got kind of unprecedented cuts to Colorado River water, you know, a roughly 2-decade-long drought. You know, water is becoming scarcer. It's obviously a huge issue, not just in Arizona, but throughout the West. And the thing about markets is they basically do a pretty good job at getting scarce resources to where they're most valued, you know, in the case of lots of different things, goods and services. You know, water may be a little bit different in some ways, but in a lot of ways, it's just like getting anything else to people and a way to allocate a resource. You know, markets are inherently cooperative. You need a willing seller and a willing buyer, obviously, rather than being rooted in conflict, which is essentially, you know, much of the political process. I reference, you know, mandated cuts coming down from on high, kind of saying how much water you can or can't use, whether that would be on like a very big level, like with the Colorado River, or even, you know, cities that sometimes saying certain cities in the West say, you know, you can only water your lawn on these days or that days, that sort of thing. But if markets are allowed to function, again, if it's a voluntary exchange of water rights, you're necessarily moving that water from a lower valued use to a higher valued use. And the way you know that's true is because if it weren't the case, if a buyer didn't value water more than a seller, then the trade wouldn't happen. And so, you know, again, that's kind of the beauty of a cooperative way, again, to allocate a scarce resource.
So here's a simple question with, I think, a large answer. What does water rights really mean, right? Because you could say I'm above a thing of water that I could drill down to, but then of course the government always figures out how to make that their water and not your water.
Sure. And, you know, that's almost like an existential question in some ways, you know, maybe to ground it a little bit more, pardon the pun, maybe.
Thank you.
You know, in the West, the doctrine of prior appropriation is the legal doctrine that governs water use. And essentially what that means is a person who first put water to beneficial use, which, you know, back in the day, you can imagine the West as being settled. That often meant diverting water from a stream to irrigate, you know, a crop field. And so people, you know, have different claims that go back to different dates on water. And, you know, that's, again, for better or worse, you might say that's been the system of prior appropriation that has evolved over time in the West. One big issue in Arizona, as in a lot of other states, and this is something we get into in our report, is that you basically, on paper, you have way more claims to water in a stream, say, or in a river, than there is actually water in the river. And so, again, on the macro scale, kind of the Colorado River is that exact situation that's happened, where you have states with claims to water. But in Arizona, you have a couple of river basins where the same thing has happened, essentially. And you have adjudications going on, just kind of a fancy legal term, adjudication for figuring out who has what claim, you know, a valid claim to what amount of water and how they're able to use it, that sort of thing. And so the fact that, you know, you can't even say who has a clear right and whether that right is secure, let alone tradable, is a big issue. And so, again, that's a few of the reforms that we kind of point to is trying to try to speed up that process in a way that, again, ultimately would let markets flourish and let markets work better, to let people adapt and make their own decisions and find ways to be flexible or find ways to conserve water.
Are there any government entities over the last 10 years or so that are seeking to erode such rights for the private property owner?
In Arizona specifically?
Or just the West? Could be the federal government. Could be.
I mean, I think that's, again, that's kind of a big question. States are very idiosyncratic, I guess, when it comes to water rights, which is another issue that makes this all so much more complicated because, you know, rivers and streams don't respect political boundaries. They respect, you know, hydrological ones. But, you know, you kind of touched on another issue, which is something that we get into the report a little bit, which relates to groundwater in Arizona, which I know is kind of been a hot button issue in some circles, at least. It's actually the case in Montana these days in certain respects. And an issue a lot of the time there is, again, a lack of clarity over who owns a right to what and, you know, what can they do with that right? Can that right be traded? And so, again, when we talk about kind of the role of government, a lot of what we think about, at least at PERC, kind of from our property rights perspective, is establishing and helping enforce those property rights is an important role if you, again, want people to have incentive to conserve something that they own and, you know, they have control over, in the case of water here, obviously.
We're talking to Tate Watkins. He's from PERC. If you don't know what that is, you're a loser. No, I'm just kidding. It's the Property and Environment Research Center. They co-authored a piece with the Goldwater Institute. And, of course, you can go over to the Goldwater Institute's goldwaterinstitute.org and hit policy reports, and you can find out more. So as we move through here, we've talked. We have our forestry professor, Dr. Neal, who contributes to the show, and we were talking about the future of what's going to go on. What he was talking about, Americans one day may have to come to grip to toilet the tap as part of a mitigation here. What do you see as the, what's the low hanging fruit right now of water, of trying to stave off water crisis or / solve it? I know technology's up there, but what other things would you say would be low hanging fruit in this battle?
Yeah. So again, I think that's a tough question because again, it's like
if you want easy ones, Tate, you can go to Wake Up Bozeman. No, I'm just kidding.
This is great. This is great. But, you know, in some cases, the low-hanging fruit in Arizona may be really high up there, I guess, is part of the issue. And so, you know, in some ways it might be just the reality is, you know, ag uses something like 3/4 of water in the state. And again, a lot of the things that I've referenced in terms of reforms that might let markets flourish and work more and say lease water and get it to places that it may be needed or valued higher again in the future could go a long way in doing that. Again, if you have willing sellers and willing buyers, that's obviously a key. I think technology is definitely there. You know, people talk about a lot of different things. You know, I haven't heard it put quite so eloquently as toilet to tap, but that technology is actually something. You know, it's direct potable reuse, I think, is the you know, pointy-headed way to say that. But
so
essentially,
boring.
Recycling, reusing, exactly, reusing water without having to put it back into, you know, a reservoir or nature some way and kind of indirectly reusing that water. And so, in one reason, again, I say the low-hanging fruit may be kind of high. Most of the water in urban Phoenix and a lot of places, I think, throughout Arizona, most of the indoor water use is already recycled, reused in some way, some, you know, form or fashion. There may be opportunities to do that elsewhere, and maybe even ways for Arizona to partner with, you know, let's say, municipalities in California or wherever who are not taking advantage of those sorts of technologies. You know, you could imagine a scenario where Arizona could help, you know, the state could help fund those sort of efforts or maybe even operate them and then trade essentially a portion of Colorado River water back in exchange. So, you know, there may be, and that's something we touch on a little bit in the report too, is kind of thinking of some relatively novel, like interstate trades ways, again, which ultimately is trying to build on the some of the beneficial characteristics of markets, even if it would be at a different, you know, larger scale, to, again, just give states and ultimately people more tools to be flexible and adapt to a changing future.
Tate, good conversation. Let's do it again soon. And check out Tate's work at thegoldwaterinstitute.org and then go to policy reports. And it's the one right on the top of the list right now. So, Tate, this is our number one issue to talk about. We say if we don't have water, all the other crap we talk about on this show means nothing. So,
yep, there you go. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Good talking to you, sir.
Thank you.
We had this horrible shooting in Nashville yesterday, and we have Dr. Curry Myers, who's making a return to the show. Curry, welcome back, sir. So every time we have a shooting like this, right, we start seeing the pattern, right, the call for gun control and various things. And then depending on the demographics of the shooter, as things move on, then there's always different reactions by the various folks depending on the demographics of the shooter. Am I getting too pessimistic in my old age?
Well, I guess we both are becoming pessimistic in our old age, because I think that's spot on. This is about individual behavior. This is about a mental health issue that we're having in our country, and for this person specifically, this is not about gun control, and this is not about an agenda on why Tennessee, you know, the legislature passed certain laws regarding the medical transitioning of minors. Unfortunately, the left wants to take those two things. The first one is the old one about guns, and if I could speak briefly about the guns, there's criminals, by definition, do not obey the law.
Correct.
That's just the way it is. So they're not.
That's
going
why
to
they're
follow
criminals.
The law. Yeah, it kind of goes hand in hand, and so they're going to obtain their firearms through the underground market. That's how they do it. So people like you and I follow the law. If we buy a gun at a gun store, we have background checks that are done. This isn't done by criminals. So I would also make the argument that we already have some of the strictest gun laws in some states, California, Illinois, New York, many others, and they have the highest mortality when it comes to gun deaths, either by homicide or suicide or accidental shootings. So it defeats the argument, but, you know, we don't live in a fact-based society anymore. we live in a society based on feelings, and we don't look at the data, and we don't use data to make our criminal justice public policy decisions. We are using feelings to determine our path forward. And the true issue that's coming out of this, as far as I'm concerned, is the incredible mental health crisis that we have in our country, and that we are not doing evidence-based mental health assessments. Similar, I've been on your show talking about evidence-based policing before. They often go hand in hand, using facts, data, in real time in order to make assessments on individuals, whether it's criminal or mental health issues, in order to act quickly to deal with the problem. And then last but not least, this is again as a school safety issue, and ensuring that all of our schools, even independent, small schools, Christian schools, Catholic schools, make sure that they follow crime prevention through environmental design standards. And in this case, you know, the shooter was able to gain access by shooting through the glass doors. But in many cases, you know, the crime prevention through environmental design recommends having a bullet resistant. It's not bulletproof. There's really no such thing, but bullet resistant glass. And if we would have had bullet resistant glass in both the exterior and that interior door where the man trap was laid out, then that could have stopped the shooter another 10 minutes. And, you know, law enforcement did an excellent job getting to the site and taking out the shooter in 14 minutes. So time really matters, and slowing down people having access to the facility is extremely important.
Well, look at what happened with the lack of that slow police response in Uvalde, right?
Oh, Uvalde was a perfect example of a major mistake for them to shelter in place and wait for a command authority and start treating it like a kidnapping scenario. Has not been taught since the since Columbine. The main way to deal with school shootings is direct to threat, and Nashville showed a perfect example of how to respond to a school shooting. The first officers, my understanding, they were under fire as well by the person shooting out the second, shooting down at the cars through the second story that she was on. They were able to get in the facility and take out that threat, and again, do it within 14 minutes. So incredibly, I'll be the first one to correct my former profession on things that opportunities for improvement and things that we missed, but they did an excellent job. And I think they also did an excellent job in their briefings, putting out information and putting out videos as soon as possible, so the public had context.
What do we know about this shooter, and what are you seeing? Is this, you know, sometimes evil is evil, right? Or the person is just so mentally sick that these horrible, evil things happen. But what are we seeing? What do we know about the shooter, and is there anything that could have been done to prevent this outside of securing the school itself?
Well, I think the first one that I found highly unusual, the probability of a female school shooter, I can literally count on one hand in the history of school shootings. So it is very, very unlikely for a school shooter to be a female. This person was a biological female that was transgendering into a male. So we don't know at what stage that transition was occurring, and whether or not she was under any sort of pharmacological effect that changed any of her hormones. Those could already always play a role. Of course, I'm not a physician, so we'd have to ask a physician more about how that could impact their decision. But the first thing, it's 99.8% of school shootings are done by males between the ages of 15 and 30. And this was highly unusual when that information came out. So that's the first thing that struck me. But we're also seeing a manifesto, and if you look at the history of school shootings, school shooters communicate. In all cases, they have communicated their intention to someone ahead of time. in this case was true. The person reached out to a friend, at least one that we know. There could be more. Also posted on social media. It's my understanding, of course, that's been wiped for right now. But she did reach out to a friend. In fact, the friend called the police. Unfortunately, she didn't call 911. She called a regular non-911 number and was placed on hold for about 5 or 6 minutes. So again, all those things count as far as time. So she did the right thing by calling police. But if you think someone's going to do harm to others, that's a 911 call, so it can get answered immediately. In the manifest, I think we're going to learn over the next few days what's in there. We do know that she had drawn maps of the school, that she had done surveillance, and not only this location, but another location. We don't know what that other location was, but she wrote in the manifest that it was too heavy in security for her to be able to launch an attack. So it goes back to school shooters. Many of them will case a location ahead of time, and based on the force protection of that individual school, they may determine to not do their event at a school that appears to be, you know, more safe than others. And what we, you know, don't want is what's occurring now in the media, which is becomes an issue of gun control first, and now it looks like it's becoming an issue of trying to have this person as a martyr for a particular agenda, just because Tennessee did what they can do under the principles of federalism and decided to do some medical transitioning legislation of minors.
Do we know why did she choose? Did she go to this school originally? Is that what happened?
Yes, my understanding, she was a student. She also the manifest hasn't been completely released, but she did make the she did write about the fact that she didn't want to go to the school and was forced to go to the school. But bear in mind, you're talking about a 28-year-old now, and that this school is a K-6 school, so that would have been some time ago. And we don't know, everybody goes through issues at different schools. We don't know her own psychopathy and issues that may have occurred to her, whether or not there could have been bullying or whether or not there was sexual abuse. There's all kinds of things that investigators are going to have to try to unpack on motive of why this person picked this particular school and targeted certain individuals. I think to me the individuals were more random, but you just never know until more information comes out.
Well, Kerr, we always appreciate your perspective on these things, and as things develop, we'll figure out more of what you're doing. And you're right about the way they cover this, right? So I just went on MSNBC. Their headline for this is "Six Are Dead in Nashville. Let's Revisit How Much the Tennessee GOP Loves Guns."
Amazing.
That's the headline at MSNBC today on this.
That's going to fix our problems, right?
Correct. All right. Well, good work as always, sir, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks. Dr. Curry Myers, always appreciate his perspective on this. Dr. DeFilippo, brought to you by Malta Joe, Maltese Delicacies, Pastizzi, Malta Dogs. All the goodness, opening up a new production facility in the next month or so. And check out MaltaJoe.com. He ships anywhere in the country. We're talking about Jan Lesher's memo about what's going to happen as they're winding out of the COVID-19 hysteria stance.
Yes.
Okay. So one of the sections in her memo, page 4, legal asylum seekers and Title 42. They're all legal. You know that, right?
Don't get me started. How can they be legal when the law on the books says that they are illegal? You can sit there. Remember, a prime stance of changing an ideological perspective is you have to assert a new language, a new definition.
I don't know if you watched the they approved that 900 G's for the Old Pueblo Community Services.
Yes,
people.
Yes, I watched it.
Which we were talking to Lisa Chastain from Gospel Rescue, that the CEO of that LitWiki, yes, went after Gospel Rescue Mission in an op-ed.
Yes.
Because they want to do treatment first and not housing first. Then, of course, they're Christian. They hate gays. They want he went full Matt Hines on it, right? So anyway, during that, they were talking about, like, their word for criminals was justice involved.
Yes.
I mean,
I love that Christy questioned it. Okay.
Absolutely.
He's the only one who had any common sense on that board. Okay.
So Jan, now here's a number. Now I want to make sure this is working, this button, I want to make sure I'm getting this right. Okay. All right. So this is from Jan's memo. Check this out. With the lifting of Title 42, which they're perceiving is going to happen in May. Okay.
May 11th, isn't it? May 11th?
I think so. This is the Public Health Services Act. The average number of people seeking care each day is anticipated to increase. So during 2022, now I haven't seen this number until now, the average number has ranged from 224 to 770 a day.
Yeah, but wait a minute. Let's stop there a minute. Remember when Christy asked, how many people have we actually serviced to date, et cetera, et cetera? He was looking for the number. And if I recall correctly, the last number I saw was, we've only done about 26,000, right?
Correct.
So within 1 month, using those numbers, we have the possibility of exceeding all the other 11 months we haven't even counted for.
So I just want to, let's just take those.
Multiplied.
770 plus the 224. That's all I got, right? So that's divided. That's 994 divided by, so we got 994 divided by 2, right? Okay. So about 400 a day, 450 a day.
Average.
Right. So we get the four.
Times. Get that little calculator out there.
450 times 365.
Yeah. Because daily. I mean, they don't stop on weekends.
All right. So that number is 164,000.
Yes. Slightly different than the 26,000. Right?
So
even if you cut that in half.
Right.
Cut it in half, you're still talking 80,000.
But wait. There's more. So Jan's now saying that once the Biden administration really opens the border and lets it rip, not that it hasn't been ripped now, right? The number is going to go to 1,200 to 1,500 a day.
Double.
Right?
Double.
So I'm just going to do this. I'm going to do it at 1,500. I just want to know the exact number. Wow, the equal. Wow.
1,500 times 365. Yeah.
500, that's a half a million. 547,000 illegal immigrants are going to be paid for by you.
That's right, because no federal money. Remember, as you well stated, Chris, the purse strings are no longer held by the Democrats. Okay? It's changed hands.
So we let this whole place fall apart over 20 years. The chickens are coming home to roost more than ever, as Barack Obama's Reverend Jeremiah Wright once said, okay? The chickens are coming home to roost, right? We let the whole place fall apart. The wastewater treatment plant, Pima Animal Care, right? We let all those facilities just fall to crap. The roads, the parks.
Oh, don't get me started on the roads. Coming back from the racetrack. I you know, I swear I'm going in a war zone.
It's terrible
on
everywhere.
On I-10 and Prince Road over there. Oh, my God. I have a truck. I can't imagine what cars do. They must be shake, rattle, and roll all over the place.
Something's happening to the Miracle Mile Bridge now because as the road reaches into the Miracle Mile Bridge, trust me, I drive it a lot, right? There's something
like a gap.
Yeah. I don't know, one's getting higher or lower.
Yeah.
Same thing on Alvernon as you go north from Ajo, the overpass over the railroad tracks and everything as it transitions to golf links.
That's sinking also?
It seems
now,
like it.
Doesn't ADOT have responsibility for that because those are main thoroughfares?
Yes. Correct? That could be an ADOT. So anyway, but what I'm saying is, so think about this. We let all this fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we have a poor as hell community overall. Right, Nanos's jail's been falling apart for 30 years.
But he needs a new jail.
And again, the one thing I do agree with Adelita is, like, why is the old stuff falling apart?
Yeah,
right. Oh, not, and it's not that old.
Yeah.
There's part of it that was built 20 years ago.
But 16 years
ago. You know what Huckleberry Buddy built that one? Figure that out, right?
Ding.
Right. Sorry,
ding.
Wasn't fast enough on that one, right?
Ding.
So, So now we're to a point in time where we have this, we've now taken our, all the money that went to Casas Alitas, right? Jot properties, worldwide dining, all of this stuff, right? Now we're going to triple.
All these people who made millions.
So we're going to triple down, right? And so we're going to triple down on this now. We have the big box where we take over somebody's failed call center. We suck. Yeah. We suck so bad workforce development wise. We can't even do call centers anymore in this town.
Okay, remember where that building is located. Okay.
Irvington and I-19.
Yeah, you want to talk about okay, people of color. Let's go in your neighborhood one more time.
So remember, Adelita was worried about Silver Lake with the Tucson Crime Free Coalition.
Yeah.
So we're now talking about 500,000 mm-hmm. people are going to now pound the I-19 and Drexel area. Now, Joe, I want to ask you a quick question. We only got a minute before break. How much do you think it costs to feed and house these people, one person for a day? What do you think? What's that number? What do you think it's going to be?
Well, you know what? I take a look at workforce development, okay? And we can allocate maybe $2,500 per person in workforce development.
Right.
Okay. I think it's probably going to cost us in excess of $3,500.
So what I'm saying, per person per day. No, per day.
Oh, per day?
How much do you think would be to house and feed them?
It's got to be at least $1,000. $500 to $1,000. At least. I mean, just the cost of, you know, housing them.
Let's do $500.
Okay.
Let's go low, right? I just want to see what that number. That's $273 million.
and here's the thing. Okay, we're now making that investment in that big box, and that's with federal money. But that federal money is going away. You taxpayers are going to have to subsidize that.
Again, this is one of those semi-permanent albatrosses around the neck of the taxpayer.
But here's my thing. I don't care what political party you are. This is called reality party.
So we're making fun of the vision thing that the Tucson's business leadership community. So it says, what can Southern, this is Thrive, you put Thrive in Tucson. It's a subpage on this, on the Chalupa Corridor page, right? So you're going to love this. With nearly 1.6 million people living in an expansive stretch of awe-inspiring and lush desert landscape. All right. 1.6 million.
I'm not sure where they came.
Where's the other 600,000 coming from? Is he trying to bring Casa Grande down to Sierra Vista into the Sun Corridor?
Or the illegal immigrants coming from Mexico and Honduras?
They're down on, we know they're on Drexel and I-19.
Right.
1,500 a day starting in May, according to Jan Lesher. So this is what we're offering. A $1 million, so a $1 million plus MSA, right? But that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything because what makes up the MSA, right? We have one of the worst miseducated workforces on the planet in this town.
I'm still trying to get past the lush desert.
So, right. So here's the other thing. You would think that possibly income, average income or demographic would mean something, you know, high, good wages or whatever. It's they sell that we have a 385,000. This is the second selling point for Tucson. We have a 385,000 median home sale price right now. This is the thing.
Well, it sounds good compared to California.
Right, right. I guess you're right. And then our median age is 33.7. Okay,
so that is good.
Yep. So the next thing is their first big section they're selling you. Is urban energy and culture.
Oh, yeah.
Urban energy.
The procession of the dead.
They do show the Day of the Dead procession. And that's it. And then it says gastronomy. There's a little button for gastronomy. And then the gem and mineral show. But it says there's an increasing variety of restaurants, nightlife, and cultural art venues. No, there's not. Even when there's a new restaurant that goes in the downtown Tucson, you don't hear about the one or two that went out.
Right.
Right? And the cultural art venues, there's not an increasing amount of that either. It's the same ones. It's called, the Rialto, the Fox, and the TCC. And, you know, and there's that little place on Toole. Okay?
Well, you got the casino south.
Not downtown.
Right.
Right? Since 08... A steady growth and diversification. It's a magnet. It's a major. So it says downtown's a major contributor to Tucson's economy.
So whoever wrote this must have got an A plus in creative writing.
This is where Laura Shaw earns her 180 G's. Thrive on less. The city is ecologically and culturally diverse with big city amenities at a much lower cost. You feel big city amenities in Tucson, Arizona? I guess it's better than Globe, right?
It may be out of pace almost with Casa Grande.
So that's the big thing. They say Southern Arizona is accomplishing a goal that many growing regions have abandoned, an ecologically sound and culturally sophisticated approach to growth and development. Does that mean, is that the nice way of saying there's no growth and development?
Well, anybody who's in the real estate business here in the Tucson area knows how favorable the government's been to real estate development.
Then they have fun with numbers. This is for the Visit Tucson stuff, right? We have lots of days of sunshine, 4 mountain ranges. So then we have when Tucsonans aren't outdoors enjoying their own favorite sport. This is one of the lead things from the losers in Sun Corridor. They can choose a variety of major spectator sports. Now here's the first thing. They show a guy doing dirt biking. Where am I seeing this? That's a lie. I know there's that 24-hour bike race. No one goes to that.
Well, at least there's no velodrome like Rio Wave wanted to do years ago.
That's true. Well, I'll ask the guy from Mosaic if he's going to do that for Chuck and that Damian Alexander guy who lives for velodromes. So, of course, U of A sports, football and basketball. Okay, got it. Good. The Culligard Classic is one of the things. So that's 3 days a year you can watch that. All right. The internationally acclaimed El Tour de Tucson. This is spectator sports, kids.
Do they talk about the rodeo?
No rodeo.
Of course, because we don't want to embrace our past.
Good Lord.
You can't put culture. The rodeo.
No.
Animal cruelty.
That's right.
Stop.
Yeah, Sun Corridor hates the rodeo. Well played, Bruce. Well
horse
played.
Racing.
Can't do
horse
rodeo.
Horse racing there.
Right.
No. How many thousand people there a week, Mark's saying?
It could be 2,000 to 4,000.
Yeah.
Right?
Every week for 12 weeks.
Yeah, it's probably the third or fourth most well-tended regular event in Tucson that is an actual spectator sport. Instead of sitting there on the corner with your bell and the bicycle guys go ding, 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 ding. Oh, and then the fourth best thing you can do for spectator sports. Oh, that's right. Go up to the superior community of Phoenix and watch all their stuff. So the rodeo doesn't get named. Even though the Tour de Tucson and the Culligard does, right? Also, the longest continuing non-mechanized parade, I think we even beat the elephant one in Thailand.
Right.
Not important to Sun Corridor and the business community because Steve Kozacik and the mayor will yell at him because it's animal cruelty. Then we have spa and resorts.
Which we do pretty well with.
Notable employers, we have that.
Half of them have barely a skeleton crew, though, left in Tucson.
All right. Here's what they say as their notable employers, Bruce. Okay? Amazon.
Great jobs. And they didn't want...
And they're everywhere.
And then,
everyone's got a freaking
And they didn't
Amazon.
Want General Instruments or Motorola or Texas Instruments here because those were factory jobs.
Don't,
these are distribution jobs.
Don't get him
jobs.
Started about Grand Canyon either. Bombardier. Okay? I know they're still there. I don't know how many people are still working at Bombardier. Caterpillar, $52 million building that no one works in, right? That's here.
How's that going to get filled when those guys finally just dump out completely?
Citibank and Geico, which I believe are call centers.
Right.
Right. Remember, we don't have enough we don't have enough people to do call center jobs anymore. We just handed over an entire building to illegal immigrants.
Right.
That's a call center. So Hexagon Mining, they're a real deal. Got that. Now, you would never put any of the other mining operations.
No.
Okay. IBM, okay.
So 7 people there.
I don't know how many people are still. I think IBM's still solid. It's more solid than anything. Raytheon, definitely, right? They're the king of this. Roche up in Oral Valley,
right.
Got it. Texas Instruments.
I think it's in Williams Center.
Okay. Too Simple, right? The guys who just got in trouble with their CEO with the company from China, right? And here's a notable employer, Worldview.
Yeah.
The guys who admittedly never hit any of their numbers, and built a building that's so small that, so think about, this is what a bunch of losers' worldview is, right? Remember, they didn't hit their employee numbers at all. Even blue check Dylan banged on them for that, right? Then the building's so small in office space that it was never going to hold the numbers they should have gotten anyway, and that's a notable employer.
And the Poindexters over at the Board of Supervisors never even asked.
Correct.
When your building hold 400 people that we're paying $15 million bucks for.
Project Curvature. So when we come back, I'm going to get to the thing that says educating the next generation. And we're going to, they got U of A, of course, Pima. They have Arizona State as one of the listings in here. So what? Winchester works for Arizona State and said, hey, you know, me and Zach think that ASU should be in this too, huh? They pay me to come to meetings and eat rubber chicken lunches and tell everyone that Zach with 7 Z's is the greatest soon elected leader ever. Is that what we're doing? I mean, that's gold. So wait till I get to K-12. I got to read the ASU thing. Oh, it's just a link to ASU. It wasn't even like why we have them there. That's amazing.
How about Grand Canyon?
You wise guy.
No way in hell. Is Grand Canyon. You think so if Sun Corridor is not going to do the rodeo, because that's not PC enough, they're not going to do everything. I'm going to say it like the Emperor in the Robe movie with Richard Burton. You think he's going to do a college with the Christians? Let's go to Dan Shearer down in Green Valley. Dan, good morning, sir. Welcome back.
Thank you.
No trips to Bismarck, North Dakota during winter storms that are happening right now?
No, but I came really close. I came really close.
Damn.
No. Might be heading up to Safford here in the next week, but we'll see. But yeah, I came really close to having to go there actually last week. So
let's talk about this story. Actually, Matt sent it to me originally off of the Green Valley News newsletter about the Pima County is... Now, we know Huckleberry, Gary Davidson illustrated on the show beautifully, all the FTEs, which are these placeholders for budget that they never fill anyway.
Right.
But they're saying they're 12% down. Is that 12% down in actual people they need, or is that a 12% kind of budget hole? What are you saying?
Actually, as of March 17th, it was 14% down, and they're just saying a shortfall in workforce. So whether these are kind of a fun with numbers type of a thing where they're doing it to pad their budgets or whatever, but I can tell you as we spoke to them and different departments, we are talking about a lot of key positions being open, and a lot of them are in the trades. The bulk of them, of course, are in the sheriff's department, whether it's at the jail or on the streets, but pretty much everybody is affected. You know, libraries, county attorney's office, facilities, courts, all of this. And so we have a ton of openings in Pima County. So, and here's the wave that's heading this way, is that in the next 5 years, they expect that 40% of the current workers at least will be eligible for retirement. Whether they take it or not, who knows? So how did we get here? Well, of course, the nation is going through this, but also COVID was a time when a lot of people just kind of reflected on their lives and said, you know what, I think I want to go move closer to my kids, or I want to just retire early, or for one reason or another, just get out of county work. And so that was part of it. But also wages, they're looking at wages. And do we need to raise these? And they're starting up some training programs, and they're going to do a partnership with Pima College just to get certain types of positions filled. So it's a big issue. And so the hard numbers are that we had, as of March 17th, just over 1,000 positions open out of 7,300 budgeted positions. So it's a lot of jobs open in the county, and it's a lot of those are costing us more because they've actually had to go to third party vendors to get some of those jobs done, or they're paying people overtime, or sometimes stuff just doesn't get done.
And then again, so I, you know, Chris's broken record. So even though they don't have a vax mandate, right, they also scared a bunch of people away, right? And I think Nanos, when asked about rehiring people who were left because of the vax mandate, I think Mr. Captain Bravado said, oh, we don't need them.
Yeah. They need them. Look, you got an open position. You need people, especially those who are trained for it. And again, we've gone over these the numbers that they've lost because of the vaccination requirement. And again, the day that you had to be vaxxed, and if not, you were dumped. That was a number that was presented to the public, but that number does not tell the whole story. That number says on that day how many got dumped, but how many dozens, perhaps hundreds, left before then because they knew that this was coming and they just didn't want to be a part of it. And I can tell you that that number is very high. So they lost a lot more people than meets the eye because of the vax requirement.
And why go back to work for a county, right, for those people that the same 3 to 4 votes can screw you again on something similar?
Right, and I think there probably just was a lot of trust lost for the workers. I think then they did remember they changed the rule that it was just people who were working with closely with other people. So the county, I think, knew early on that it was in a sense, painting itself into a corner with this. But they stuck to their guns and they moved forward. And I can tell you, deep within the county, there are a lot of people who acknowledge off the record that they screwed up, or that they shouldn't have gone at it as hard as they did. But I think they were trying to. There were some people in the county who were trying to make a point, and they did. And now they're paying the price for it. And these numbers scream that to us.
I think the other thing that's interesting about the dynamic of this, Dan, is we're in a community still, and everything you said, I'm with you in relation to people moving on other jobs, or they moved to another city where their kids were with grandkids and all that. But so we're still a market of 1 million people, right?
Right.
1 million people, and the Pima County would be one of the holy grails of jobs in this community, right? U of A is probably number one, right? But then number two is the county. So when you talk about the pay, and they have done some bumps over the last year or two, they also have a sweet benefits program. They gave them extra COVID days just for breathing, right? They didn't raise the insurance unless you had COVID. You didn't want your COVID vax. That was another thing they were idiots about, right? But, the insurance for people, the idea that they pay that much of your insurance, that's gold for a bunch of people. So what's the idea that out of 1 million people, and this is going to reflect on biggest problems, there's not enough people qualified to work at the county? Is that what we're running into?
I don't know that it's not enough to be qualified to work for the county, because we actually do go into how many applications they actually receive per month, and it's around 2,000, and that had dropped dramatically earlier this year, actually. But just to even have that pool of candidates, you know, they've been having a problem with that. But you're right, the county is absolutely not a bad place to work for at all, especially if it's a job that you enjoy doing and you want to help people and be into public service and everything. There are drawbacks, of course, but for the most part, a lot of those are 9-to-5 jobs and not bad as far as the benefits go. And you're right, the pay is getting back up there. So why do people not want these jobs? Well, in general, we have seen a lot of people just try to get into that gig economy and string together 3 or 4 little jobs and that allow them to work remotely. And so they are trying that. A lot of them find it doesn't work and they have to go back to traditional work. But there's a lot of reasons for it. I don't know that it's a bias against the county.
What's the gross number of jobs that they have to fill?
1,036.
So think about that. You're telling me they're getting somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 apps a month, and they still
a little over 2,000. They had 28,000 applications submitted in 2022, and so
that sure sounds like a lot of unqualified people applying for jobs.
Yeah, and it very well could be that too. So, they're not filling a lot of them. for various reasons. But yeah, this is a story full of numbers, and they're very interesting, and you can look at them lots of different ways. But the county's in trouble, without a doubt, as far as employment goes.
Let's go to Eastside, Matt, on line 12, right before we go to regular. Matt, what were we going to say, buddy?
Well, you can make the argument on the trade things that there's not enough qualified applicants. You can certainly make that argument.
Sure.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
That has long been an issue, but they actually, again, are starting a training program, so they'll take people in with less experience than they would have in the past, and they'll just, you know, train them up. And the trades are seeing a lot of that because fewer young people have gone into them. So they're at least making efforts here.
Dan Shearer, great job as always. Good morning to Joey and Celeste dancing in the streets. How are you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
We're not quite awake yet, but we're good.
That's okay. You dance people you're like night people. So for the rookies who just never heard of a dancing in the streets, tell them what dancing in the streets is, please.
Dancing Street, we are a 501(c) nonprofit ballet school in the city of South Tucson. We'll take anybody who is passionate to do ballet.
We specialize in low-income families and non-traditional ballet dancers. We have able-bodied and non-able-bodied dancers in our performances. We've been open. We're going to go on 15 years in August. We're over in South Tucson, which is a one-square-mile city, which has the most densest population of underserved community.
Communities, right?
Yeah.
So usually, you know, we're here under not so great circumstances.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And usually, you're very joyful. You're dance people. You're dancing in the streets, for God's sakes.
Okay? Absolutely.
You should be dancing away from the streets.
That's true.
Is the name.
I know dancing in the potholes.
Right.
Is not,
exactly.
Could be another subsection of the 501(c). So I saw you guys. I was watching the Pima County Board of Soups meeting a couple of Tuesdays ago, and you guys were on fire for one of your students. Mm-hmm. And Joey even exited mid-speech, stage left, and did a Bruce Lee kick to the door to open it up. Yeah. And Joey threw himself out of the meeting.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. Chris.
You know, usually Adelita has someone else throwing people out of the meeting. You self-ejected.
Yeah, because I didn't want to give them that satisfaction, Chris.
So this is part of this horrible, messy situation. Mm-hmm. Horrible situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With Dev Martinez, the constable, mm-hmm. and the apartment manager.
Correct. Right.
Serving an eviction notice on a tenant that was really well known to be unstable, violent, and gun wielding.
Yep.
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 And so this is going to be a horrible thing I'm going to do to you when we come back, because mm-hmm. I don't want to break you admitting, we're going to talk about your student,
okay,
Elijah Miranda.
Okay.
Because this is what, and so I guess my one question, what was your purpose at the Board of Soups meeting to go there and talk about this situation at that point? Why now? What was the purpose? And what do you want? What do you want through your passion and mm-hmm. getting this out? What do you want to get out of this?
Okay.
For Elijah or his family or mm-hmm. or just what's right?
Right.
We're talking now, or
sure.
It's really simple. At the time of the apartment, the Lynn apartment incident, the city and the county were very quick to honor the constable with a parade and all the regalia and half staff flags. And I kept waiting for anyone to say,
"And this go ahead.
Our condolences to the family of Elijah Miranda and the landlord's family." I kept waiting to hear some kind of acknowledgement.
Something
and for his loss.
Basically, you know, and then this was all happening even before the investigation was not even done with yet.
Right.
So
they didn't even started the investigation.
Oh, they
didn't
even started it.
This
yet.
This is right after the incident. Nobody acknowledged anything. Mm-hmm. No one called, reached out. Mm-hmm. It was like the constable's life was so much better because of the position, and everybody else was just collateral damage.
Right. Right.
And
right.
they also portrayed him to be somehow he was a
like
criminal.
He was a criminal, or something.
Or was there doing a crime? Right. And so right. you know, mm-hmm. of course, that's what happens. And it was totally not that way. He was visiting a friend.
All right, hold that thought. I got to go to break.
Okay.
We're on Wake Up Tucson. I want to talk about this more. It's very important. Mm-hmm. And you are right, right? It was the idea. I remember going to Deb's funeral going, what happened to the other people?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
They weren't even mentioned by half the, quote, dignitaries that were talking about it.
Or
that,
the media.
Yeah.
Or the media, exactly.
So Elijah was a member of your Dancing in the Streets, right?
Correct.
We had him at age 10 to about 17.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
This kid's like your child.
Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely.
So tell me about him becoming a dancing with you guys. Where, you know, was this something that, you know, if it wasn't for you, he wouldn't be doing what he loved to do? It would be just tough?
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, it kind of started off with his younger brother. And I was teaching at our Parks and Rec, and his mother brought in the younger brother, and I started teaching him, and then he used to just hang around and watch his younger brother.
Gotcha.
And what happened was, when we started dancing in the street, his younger brother quit, and he decided to jump aboard.
They both started with us at Dancing in the Streets Arizona when we opened it up, and then Skylar kind of dropped out, but Elijah just took a love to it. Mm-hmm. And he was there every day, and he was a scholarship student because he really had a desire. He kept asking for more classes. I mean, he basically lived at our studio.
Right.
We fed him, we picked him up, we took him home to classes. Mm-hmm. His mother would come and just hang out at our studio.
Right.
I mean, they were their ballet parents.
Right, pretty much, yeah.
Was he living the dancing dream after he left you guys?
He kind of he lived his life pretty much.
Gotcha.
You know, because, you know, as Dan,
he was 25 at the time.
At the time he was working in McDonald's. He was working up to be a manager, you know, because you know, so he was living his life.
But here's a kid trying to improve his life.
Exactly. 25, you know, 25 years old in Tucson, that's really hard to do.
Trust me, I know.
You know,
I've done 14 years of show about that.
Right. Yeah.
He had a couple of deaths in his family that sort of sent him into a little, sidetracked his life a little bit. So he had some problems with working through that, and then he was sort of came out the other side of the fire.
Mm-hmm.
So he was doing really well. He was the kindest kid. He would give you the shirt off his back. Huge, giant, gentle giant. I mean, he was just this big presence, but he was super kind and considerate and caring and wanted to help everybody.
He was a Yaki boy. You know how Yakis are very huge men, you know? And he was a huge boy. And I remember when I stuck him in white tights, he says, "Are you sure this is going to be good, Mr. Rogers?" I said, "You're going to be fine." And he came out on stage and everybody went, because they saw how big he was. And then when he started dancing, people were just amazed how
fluid a dancer was, lyrical.
Lyrical he was.
But with he wasn't effeminate in any way in his dancing.
Mm-hmm.
He was lyrical and he just moved smoothly. You would expect a bigger dancer to sort of not do well or be loud. He was smooth and lyrical without being effeminate.
Right.
And he loved it. He would light up on stage.
Yep.
He lived for that stage experience. And I think what we gave him with Dancing in the Streets Arizona is a way to channel negative feelings and emotions into a positive outcome. The art.
You know,
you come to ballet class, you block out everything else, and you actually use that energy while you're physically training.
Okay.
So we gave that gift to him that he carried through his life.
Yeah.
And the self-discipline that ballet
that gives. Exactly.
Gives you.
Family life was, mom sounded great. Dad in this kid's life?
Dad was an alcoholic, died very young, and that's where I came in, Chris.
Yeah, I'm with you.
You know what I'm saying? I was pretty much his father figure, so that's where I came in. So
on this horrible day, Elijah is next door at a friend's house.
Correct.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Correct.
And he's just sitting there, basically. The friend left a little bit to pick somebody up or whatever, and he was just sitting there, and a bullet came through the wall. Is that what
happened? Well, not quite.
He went there to, you know, it was a hot day, and he called his friend, say, "Hey, can I chill at your house? Because you got air conditioning."
Right.
And he's like, yeah, come on over. So he was chilling, and his friend said, "Hey, Elijah, I have to go pick up my daughter. Would you like to come with me?" Elijah said, "Oh no, man, I'm cooling out." So that's I wish he would have went with that dude.
His friend was actually the tenant in the apartment complex, and that his friend was actually the target of the harassment from the shooter. The shooter had threatened that tenant and his daughter frequently, and that was actually the point of the eviction. He was being evicted for his harassment of this neighbor. When Elijah chose to stay behind, the incident began, and the shooter, after shooting through the door to killing the constable and the landlord, he then broke through the wall to the neighboring apartment complex, and Elijah was on the couch, and he shot him.
Chris, that should tell you how cheap these apartments were if this dude jumped right through a wall.
He jumped through the wall?
He broke through the wall.
And he found himself in another apartment.
Well, he knew it was the neighbor's apartment. That was the intent. Right.
But that's how paper thin these walls were.
Yikes. So we were talking about off air. This is going to become a lawsuit crossfire right now.
Yes, it is.
Because you have the apartment manager. They just filed their claim, and it notified the county they're going to get sued. I assume Elijah's family is possibly thinking about this, and Deb's family is going to sue also.
Right.
So we're finding out more. Deb didn't have a bulletproof vest. She was never properly trained. We're finding out from the claim from the apartment manager's family that she had multiple chemicals in her system, including meth, alcohol, and what was
cocaine.
Holy crap.
She was amped. Yeah.
Right? So you got that going on. Right? And then we're finding out that the murderer's parents did try to notify TPD, and that, you know, they showed up once, but he wasn't home, so... And again, they have no officers to go to even do...
To do that.
They're barely covering... You know, fentanyl crackheads jumping on people in the middle of their business.
Right.
Let alone, oh, we got a guy who might be a problem in an apartment.
Right.
So all of these horrible dynamics came crashing in to ruin all of these lives and families' lives.
Yeah, there's no one thing that you can say was the cause. There were multiple reasons. And what prompted all this is the report from the investigation was released about a week before we had gone to Pima County.
We
heard from his mother, and that triggered her back into grief and us to think about it. And after reading the report, and you find all of these actions contributed to the deaths of everyone, including the constable herself. And it sort of just stirred us up and said, nobody see this coming?
Well, it's not even that. It was the supervisors who we were really heated about. So that's why we went down there and voiced our concern.
Why were you heated about the supervisors?
I just felt like, you know, they should have acknowledged a human life. The landlord and Elijah were not others, you know, and that's the way the reports were coming out. You know, this constable was shot, and there was this huge, huge deal about it. And then it was like, and two others died, including the shooter himself. I mean, every life is valuable. And for them to not even acknowledge, they did a whole big tribute to honoring the
tribal
land. And he was a Yaki boy. And I felt like, wow, you did this whole word acknowledgement, and yet a Yaki life was taken, and not even we're so sorry for your loss.
What do you want to get out of your heart right now before we end our conversation?
I'd say that I feel blessed to have been a part of this boy's life, and I feel blessed that we were able to help this family through the art of ballet, and that we are still helping the family even after Elijah has gone to Heavenly Father.
I am thankful to Virginia, his mother, give me the trust and the support to, you know, let me to teach her son, you know, not even about ballet. I mean, we will ride in the car, just talk about life.
Sure.
School, girls. Just everyday stuff, you know, that he wanted to get off his chest. So I'm just glad that I was there to do that for him.
I feel honored that I was able to know this boy and see this boy grow, and that his mother gifted us with that responsibility and honor.
Yeah.
You know, that she trusted us. Ballet is not something that is culturally accepted by a lot of different cultures. So.
Yeah, Chris, we're in Dancing Street. We're more than a ballet school.
Well, so there's that family you're born into, right?
Right.
And then there's the family you build.
Right. Right.
Well, in
right.
15 years, we've definitely built a number of ballet families, and we're starting to get to the age where we're running into second and third generation.
Yeah, absolutely, so. Absolutely. But
I'm so glad he met you guys. I want this conversation to be an ongoing thing.
Chris, it's not over. Like you said, there's going to be a slew of multiple, and this story is not, that's the sad part. This is not over.
Survive the Grand Canyon, I assume because he's calling us, and a $23 hamburger at the McDonald's right outside the gate.
Actually, it's the Wendy's, but we have this weird tradition. I've been doing this for like 40 years, is get out, get a root beer float.
You earned it, as we like to say.
At that moment, I've earned every bit of that sugar and carbs.
I was looking at a story this morning about the... It had to do with the amount of money that's missing that has to do with COVID money for private schools, not the public schools. And it's some horrible number, like $736 million. So I was deciding I should ask David about what's going on in the world of COVID fraud and tracking down all of those zillions of dollars that were supposed to go out, maybe weren't spent. Give me the Schweikert report on those dollars, please.
It is pretty much close to $1 billion. I'm of the school that this is the largest fraud almost in human history. And you got to walk through this with me because it's in a couple different tiers or pillars or however the hell you want to call it. The government analysis say, hey, it may be $140 billion of unemployment fraud. We have an outside analytic group says, no, we think it may be as high as $400 billion of stolen unemployment money. And so we're doing something a little different in Ways and Means Oversight. We're actually trying to understand how they did it. So we're breaking it up. The whole committee is going to go after the failures of the bureaucracy of state unemployment offices. We want to understand how they wash the money. And for anyone that's listening in Tucson, if you ever saw the Craigslist ad saying, hey, we have a job opportunity, go to this P.O. box, grab these checks, find some way to cash them, turn them into gift cards, turn the gift cards into cash, turn the cash into Bitcoin, send it to us in Serbia. We're trying to get a couple people who've been convicted of this and see if we can actually work out a deal with the DOJ and others saying we want some of the perpetrators of the money laundering to actually come and testify. So this is a big deal, and it's just been painful because every time we think we're understanding what happened, it turns out there's another wrinkle of another part of the scam.
What was the where was the damage on the PPP money in relation to that kind of fraud? What's that number at?
See, that one we don't know yet. We're still diving into that. So you got to remember, you had on the unemployment, we still think maybe the biggest. Then we also have a lot of the other COVID monies out there. We're trying to track it down, but we could be looking at several hundred billion dollars that was either misspent or just absolute fraud.
So there's definitely
it makes you almost, when you sit with the team, you almost shake in anger when you're seeing how this was handled.
We all know some business people that we may know that took PPP money, and there was no evidence they actually spent it on anything that had to do with their business or employees, right? And so for those people, is the federal government really going to track them down and go, hey, bro, why didn't you spend the money on that?
But remember, that's actually the easier money to track. And that's already being chased. You know, and it's not a good look when you needed the payroll protection money to protect your business, and the next day you're driving a new McLaren.
Right.
The unemployment fraud is the one that we're fixated on at this moment. We're working on the others, trying to build the data files and trying to figure out, meet with the investigators. But that one we think may be 4 or 5 times bigger.
Yeah, I know a couple of businesses in the state where the owner took the PPP money and then immediately closed and retired.
Yep. Right? And that's actually an absolute violation. Now you've got to help me find a way to chase down and say, I'm sorry, taxpayers deserve that money back. And so this is going to be going on for years.
87,000 IRS agents, right? No.
yeah. Well, that's you laugh about it, but first off, there's not 87,000 out there to hire.
That's true,
you
know, too.
It's just so much of this is just made up math. That was one of the questions we had. Saying, okay, where in America are you going to find 87,000 people that qualify for an IRS job? So you got to pass the background checks and all these other things, and have an accounting background.
Yeah, and just be good at math. I can't find Americans good at math.
And so that's actually one of the other things we're working on is what would it take? The Department of Defense is substantially on highly encrypted cloud computers. They don't maintain their own servers and their own storage. Why the hell can't I get the IRS off of its own servers and its own storage? Because one of the funniest things in life is the report about the IRS's IT, their information technology in West Virginia's their server farm,
right,
before it's sinking into the ground because their old servers are so heavy. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And then they fight with us when we want to say, why aren't you like doing what everyone else has been doing for 20 years and get on the cloud? And you can encrypt it where, you know, it's functioning bulletproof.
You're so cute dancing through the garden of logic. I just love it.
It's like the castle in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Actually, somehow today is the day of Monty Python references. I swear, I was just running down the hallway and someone was clasping coconuts behind me. And you got to be a real fan to get that reference.
It's beautiful. Friend of the show, defeater of worldview, Tim Sandifer. We've been talking to you and, of course, Austin van de Heijden of Goldwater Institute about this horrible thing called the Zone in Phoenix. We had Austin come down here and tour a place that's doing it better called the Center for Opportunity right down here by the Gospel Rescue Mission. And Tucson has lots of little zones, well, and larger zones blowing up all over the town. So we're very interested in this case. Tell us about the lawsuit and tell us about the judge's decision in the last 48 hours.
Yeah, it's not just Phoenix and Tucson. I mean, the homeless problem has exploded across the country, and particularly on the West Coast. And what the decision from this week from the Maricopa County Superior Court says is it orders the city to start enforcing the law, including the laws against public camping, which the city of Phoenix has for well over a year now has consciously refused to enforce in the zone. And that has led to the city of Phoenix operating basically its own open-air homelessness shelter on the streets of the city, which now there's more than 1,000 people who are living in tents on the streets of the city, which has instructed its police officers not to enforce the law in this area. And so the judge in this case has ordered the city to put a stop to that, and by July 10th, take steps to start eliminating this lawless section of the city.
So what's the timing of this thing work like, Tim? Like, when does it have to be done by? Is the city of Phoenix, are they going to be a bunch of babies and try to, I assume they're going to appeal this thing? How does that work?
Well, you know, obviously the ball is in their court, and they do not have to clean up the zone by July 10th. They have to take steps in that direction and show the judge that they're actually trying to do something by that time. So this is really just the first step. But it's a very very important one, because until now, the city, and this is not just true in Phoenix, this is true in a lot of other cities, but Phoenix leaders have been using an excuse for refusing to act. They've been pointing to this Ninth Circuit decision from 2019 called City of Boise, where the Ninth Circuit said that it was cruel and unusual punishment to arrest somebody for sleeping on the street if that person can't help it. And since that decision came out, city leaders across the country have been using it as an excuse for refusing to do anything about homelessness and refusing to enforce city laws, even against like people publicly urinating and defecating in the streets. And what this decision makes clear is that that case does not say that. It does not give the city an excuse to ignore its own laws, and they have to start enforcing those laws by at least July 10th.
So we have various groups in Tucson that are trying to make this better for taxpayers, the working poor, and business owners. Some aren't, but so I've heard, I've been in part of different discussions about down here about someone suing or a group suing the city of Tucson. How would this play out in setting any sort of precedent for a group maybe in Tucson to do something similar with the city of Tucson?
Yeah, it certainly could work. Now, it depends on the facts of this and circumstances. The Phoenix case, one of the important things about the case was there was testimony from police officers saying, we would like to enforce the law in the zone, and the city won't let us. And evidence that in the city police were actually taking people to the zone from other neighborhoods in Phoenix, and of course neighboring cities also, they've been telling their homeless population, oh, go down there to Phoenix because that's where you're supposed to be, which is a nice easy way for them to solve their homelessness problem, right?
Sure.
So there's been this behind the scenes conscious effort by the city to operate this zone, which. What the zone is it's a giant homelessness shelter that does not require you to stop drinking or using drugs to live there. In a ordinary homeless shelter, if you want a bed for the night, they'll let you have a bed, but you have to not use drugs and not drink on the property and so forth. And when offered the choice to do that, the residents of the zone have repeatedly said, no, we don't want that. We want to stay in our tents because we can continue to use drugs and so forth. And the city has been allowing that to continue, which is, again, that's not what the Ninth Circuit ruling said in that City of Boise case, and Phoenix has no excuse for doing that. So if people can prove the same facts in any other city, Tucson, Portland, anywhere else, then they can go to court and demand an order that says the city has to start enforcing its laws. That's what the city is there for. That's what their police are paid for. That's what city mayors and leaders are paid for by tax dollars, by the way, that are taken from small businesses who are being ignored and their rights violated, and nobody really seems to talk about that.
Yeah, we talked about that. I know it's been covered by the one lady who has that design studio or something down there, and she's gotten what her original appraisal for her to sell it, right? But of course, the appraiser said, well, with the zone thing there, basically, this is an unsellable property.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And there's lots of small businesses in this area who not only have their customers been scared away, but a lot of the homeless are suffering from mental illness or drug abuse and so forth, and they're dangerous and violent, and they're a danger to the employees of these small businesses. And so it's ruined that, and the public urination and defecation has physically damaged many of the buildings that are housing these businesses. So one of the people that we represented in the lawsuit in Phoenix, the Arizona Rock Products Association, they told how they had to replace all the seals on their windows in their building because they had been corroded by so much urine from the homeless population just peeing on the side of their building. And again, the city refuses to do anything. Yeah, precisely.
So one of the listeners just messaged me and wanted to know, because you mentioned it a little bit, that other cities are sending their homeless to Arizona?
Other cities in the Phoenix area. So we've received secondhand reports of, like, Tempe, for example, telling the homeless population, well, you go down there to the zone. They'll let you stay there. And, you know, it's convenient for the city of Tempe, right?
So next to the zone, there's the Cass place, right? I think it's called Cass, right?
Right. Right.
And this is kind of the place where they can go get a meal and a shower. They're not allowed to stay overnight. Does that seem to be more of an enabler of the situation than a help?
You know, I don't know the direct answer to that, but there has been that sort of situation has come up before. In 1985, there was a case in the Phoenix area where a homelessness a kitchen, a church, you know, set up a kitchen for the homeless to come and get free meals, and this attracted such a large population of the homeless who then loitered in the area and stayed there and trespassed on people's property and damaged their property and everything. So they sued and said this was a nuisance, and it went up to the Arizona Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, yes, even though your motives are perfectly good, nevertheless, once you do something like this, if you are attracting people to this property and they're committing crimes, then you are responsible for the public nuisance. Well, the same rule applies to the city, and the city has been doing that in spades here. They've been inviting people to this area and refusing to police the streets. And as a result, you have violent crime, you have murder, you have arson. This is a dangerous fire area. And the city could take steps. The judge's opinion makes clear that the city could take steps immediately to help solve this problem by, for example, building a structured campground instead of just letting people pitch their tents on the sidewalks. And the city has refused to do that because they have this idea that, well, we don't want to build anything unless we can make it, you know, top quality, Cadillac quality housing for people. It has to have air conditioning, for example. And the judge's opinion, he points out, well, they don't have air conditioning in their tents as it is. So you might as well at least temporarily improve their situation with a structured campground while you find other solutions to this problem. But the city has pretended that its hands are tied under that Ninth Circuit ruling instead.
What does the so we have the dynamic down here. We're talking to Tim Sandifer, VP of litigation for Goldwater Institute, that cops are arresting some of these people. Well, and the city of Tucson's actually not getting, I think it might be a similar situation, or not happy with cops that are hiring, that are basically arresting crime-breaking, violent drug vagrants. But then they get to the courts, right? And you have these judges that are just kicking them back on the streets, or attorneys that don't want to prosecute. Our county attorney's extra special down here.
Yeah. I think that is a major part of the problem. There's an ideological movement that has taken hold. I mean, it's always been around, but it has really taken hold in the past couple of years that for ideological reasons absolutely will not view the world in terms of people taking responsibility for their own lives. And that is why the city has been using the city of Boise ruling as an excuse, because they say, well, unless we can provide people with a shelter bed, then that means that they're involuntarily sleeping on the streets. But when you actually look at the facts, for example, there's another lawsuit actually against Phoenix about the zone. In that case, there's a couple homeless people who are the plaintiffs, but if you read their complaint, one of them has been living on the streets for 23 years, and another one testified that she gets Social Security income and keeps like food and clothing and all sorts of stuff in her tent. And well, that's not involuntary. That's not somebody just happening to fall asleep on the street because he can't help it. These are people who have chosen this lifestyle, and if they've chosen this lifestyle, they can be held responsible for doing so. And it's become really popular politically in this country for the past couple years to say that there's something cruel about expecting somebody to take responsibility for their own lives. That's not cruel. That's expecting of them the kind of dignity that you would extend to any other human being. That is true compassion.
I know there's people down in Tucson that want to take a run at the city of Tucson for also abdicating their responsibility and in a legal manner. And
Well, this is the first step of a long process, but it is a long overdue first step, and it is very welcome.
And return of the prodigal son, Joseph. Hold on. Microphone for Joseph.
Good morning, Ed.
I mean, morning, Matt.
Thank you. Had that one coming. Had the wrong one on.
Don't ask me the question.
How's things going? Catch me up real quick. Because I'm seeing the homelessness and I'm on that neighborhood app. Oh. I have not introduced that to my wife because it's so scary.
Oh, yeah. She'll just.
Are you on it?
No.
Oh.
It's just called neighborhood?
Porch step. Yeah. It's neighborhood, your neighborhood or your neighborhood app. You get on it and you put the neighborhood you're in. It's like a Facebook for a real small neighborhood, your area.
Right.
And everybody puts in there what happened.
Oh, God.
Car got broken into, you know, cameras with people taking stuff off their porch. Bad. Homelessness.
So.
Bad.
To your answer, we'll keep it short and quick.
All right.
Devolving crap hole.
Are you talking about the federal government or are you talking about state? Or are you talking about city?
City of Tucson.
Oh, okay.
And it's out of control. It's out of control. It's, you know, we have free buses, right? They want to do it again, right? And which is,
well, that'll solve it.
Which just spreads the crime all over the place.
How would you like to be a bus driver in that world?
Oh, they hate it.
Yeah.
They just hate it. And that's coming up Tuesday at the city council meeting to do it again. They just need to, you think about it, when we started the show 14 years ago, you were looking into how much we were already supplying money into that bus system, which, right, I thought was 45 to 50 mil then. Right, and now we're just going to keep making it free, and you're just like,
"How's our cops doing?" That's the
horrible. It's horrible. We're still in a negative trend that one day there'll be no cops.
Is it the point where
and the police chief just admitted to Cavazos about 4 weeks ago on the air that he doesn't have enough cops to cover the city anymore?
Mm. Well, good. I'm in the county, so Sharon, you're in Oro Valley. Yeah, so.
It's coming, dude. You're lower foothills, remember?
I am lower foothills.
I mean, you're right. You're right on the front line, dude.
I'm riffraff. I'm trying to be. I'm a wannabe.
And you're near the Rito River, right? Because that's part of the super highway of the homeless, right?
Yeah.
So they just lit the wash behind Walmart and La Cholla by Foothills Mall on fire. Right. So when does that take out a neighborhood one day? Right. I mean, Dr. Neil and us, we're worried about lightning strikes. The fentanyl homeless guys are going to burn down neighborhoods before this is all over.
So you and I, towards the end of my tenure on the show with you, I got to the point where the market will decide. It's going to be a market decision, right?
Sure.
So TUSD will go by the way of school choice because other schools will come in and other opportunities will happen if they don't evolve and change. City of Tucson. But then when you look at a Portland, Oregon, and you think, how far does it have to devolve before you start voting against Democrat? I'm a D, my family's a D, I'm going to vote D, and you keep putting Ds in office and they keep doing these things to you. When do you start waking up and going, man, my property values are lower, my quality of life has gone down, my kids have moved out of town?
So, and I think one of the things that will, one of our themes today might be, right, is tribalism rules, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And your tribalism will totally burn through whatever you think is the reality.
Right.
I mean, look at the fools that keep supporting. I mean, you said this 10 years ago. You said, Chris, let's say the whole city of Tucson devolves. They go bankrupt, blah, blah, blah. What's the percentage that all seven Democrats on the council get reelected? And I was like, I don't know, 97%, right?
Yep. With still, the Ukraine flag hanging there and the still, Black Lives Matter.
Still true to this day.
Well, look at Portland. Right. I mean, Portland's we've always kind of compared ourselves to Portland. They're a little prettier and they had a little better mojo going.
In reality, we're Detroit of 10 years ago.
Yep. Yep. Have you noticed going into stores lately, Walmarts or Ross's or whatever, security guards up front?
Oh, they're everywhere.
Sheriffs. There's a sheriff at the Walmart on Wetmore the other day. I went in there, standing at the front.
Ooh, Wetmore that's, Walmart.
That's paid.
That's
a paid spot. They're paying that guy to sit there all day long.
So remember that Starbucks just south of there, they closed the dining room area because of the homeless guys.
Try to find a restroom in a public place anywhere in town. Which is, it's an ADA responsibility. You have to have a restroom in a public space. But every store I'm going into, restrooms are closing. You go up into your world in Oro Valley, clean, open.
Sure. We have proper cops and, it takes a little harder to get up to the OV.
Yeah. The solution to all of this stuff is churches, families, and schools.
Yeah.
You've got to go to first principles and start with the next generation to explain to them. All this stuff we're seeing with tearing down statues and the politics of our day are downstream from where our kids went to school and what our churches did 25, 30 years ago.
Amen.
So the game is the nature that if you want to be active and get in there, churches, families, and schools, something that applies to those things, and you will see some benefits. Maybe not in your lifetime. Might take you 35 years to see that fruition happen, but that's where the battlefront is.
This is the conversation you and I have been having for the last 4 or 5 years, right? Yep. When we're around the old fire in Patagonia.
Could I care less about who's the president? Really, no. I mean, could I care less about who's our city council member in Tucson?
So
not really.
What we're learning
is it comes down to churches, families, and schools.
The ballot boxes are temporary fixes. We used to close hours with this one instead of Python. So, let's get to the first ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch.
He was OG transgender, too. Had to get that in before 7.
I think J. Edgar Hoover had him beat by a few decades.
Oh!
Nice, Matt, nice.
I was doing a lot of wake up memories on Facebook, and so I did a picture of Patty and thanking for all her support, and I said she's gotten a lot better handling the complaint calls.
many moments of those fun, just crazy. When you do this, as you listen, folks, you know the routine, right? You'll have a restaurant owner one day, and then you'll have a small business guy, and then you have U.S. senator,
right?
So you just never know what's coming through the booth and what conversation you're going to have,
sure,
and what comes up.
That's what makes the show fun to do and hopefully listen to is that variety. Because if we just did all political, like we keep saying, we just beat ourselves in the head with a rock.
We tried to do positive Mondays. How long did that last?
About a week and a half.
Right. Where the whole day we tried to say only thing positive, nothing negative.
One of our other proto-wakies, Gloria, had great hope for that.
Yeah.
And then that was over.
Ran out of room.
So Bill was talking, I think the greatest legacy of the show, whenever they run us off, is always going to be these relationships.
Yeah.
Right? So all of the things that have come up from those connections, right? Things that you and I have done business-wise, educationally,
charter schools,
all these things, right? Comes from the show, right? And then those friendships, and this is where I want to bring in Adriana, right? So Adriana comes out of nowhere and says, love the show, and I think you guys should do these happy hours. And I'd love to be your unpaid event director.
We've got a lot of unpaids in our life. Well, unpaid interns. We've got a whole bunch of them.
And so she started putting these things together on a regular basis.
Right.
Right. And that really cinched the connection of the community, that you had these like-minded human beings from various walks of life and religions and geographically and all, come together and start building those friendships. Because we could all be a radio, kind of, hey, we all like the show, but until you meet each other, right? And so that's the biggest legacy of the show, are always going to be those friendships, right?
That we're tribal by nature, right? Humans. That's why churches are important. That's why Rotaries are important. That's why community, getting to know your neighbors, is important. And what do we do during COVID? The first thing they do is keep you away from other people.
Yep.
And that's why the mental health crises are happening in the young kids or the older folks.
Correct.
Get out there and get engaged. And this is a community that may think like you, may have some commons, but it's just people. It's people to know.
I've had so many people say, I have met friends through a radio show, that we will be friends to the day we die. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. To me, if that's the legacy of the show,
mm-hmm.
I'm good. I'm
Amen.
Way good.
Amen, Reverend Chris.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, one other one I'm going to add to you.
Yes, sir.
As we did this show, I looked at the news media, kind of, you know, I read Washington Post, New York Times, NBC, CBS, ABC, and I would get to these fringe blogs and ideas and other articles, and I'd be very careful on air talking about some of them. Then it got to the point where, okay, that's a little bit to the left. It's pretty clear. NPR, what don't they talk about? We had that talk one time. What don't they bring up on NPR,
sure.
Right?
It's about a mission.
I think the Trump 2016 to 2020 opened this Band-Aid and made them all apoplectically overreact to the point where they exposed the dirty little secret that they're all kind of on the left, and they have an agenda. Then you go through these Matt Taibbi and the Twitter files and what's happening and the exposure, and you're like, oh boy, it's much deeper and more insidious than we even
Absolutely.
Ever thought.
We were having a discussion yesterday about just, you know, everyone, you know, in relation to all of this breaking open, right? And in the end, right, it all comes down to the Trump election,
mm-hmm.
right? And we just talked about how him being that guy who challenged the bureaucracy. We right. said he was going to be an atomic bomb on 535 congresspeople,
right?
Plus a Supreme Court and an entrenched bureaucracy that doesn't want change, right? And he came in as such a bombastic kind of guy, right? And all those people at that, when he got elected, because they couldn't believe he got elected, was all those, everyone activated to kill that guy,
right?
Right. And then everyone,
they dropped the veneer of trying to be impartial, or like universities. Let's look at, you know, every institution that we own.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, wow, I didn't know you're that far deep in there. Oh man, there's another one.
Right. Universities, schools,
yep.
right?
The bureaucracies.
Church. Right. right? We saw it across the board, and then the media was totally exposed.
Right. So that's, I think, a big change from 14 years ago. Never would have ever guessed that creep had been so deep and creep into the world.
It was there.
Yeah.
Joe Higgins, Christy Simone, and you. Why are you laughing?
I'm thinking about remotes.
Ah,
how much
okay.
I hated doing remotes.
So remotes were always dicey, and then Joe was always a little shy, a little gun shy on a remote. And then the finishing move was the World Match Play Tournament up at Dove Mountain.
Right.
We're going to do a remote in the media tent.
Right.
And we get there. ESPN's next to us to the right. The BBC's there, right? Global, all the technology in the world, right? It looked like NORAD when we walked in there. Terry Live, God rest her soul, right? Set up the remote. She tested it the next day. Joe's like, all right, this is going to be good.
We made it.
Didn't work.
Nothing worked. Couldn't hear, couldn't speak, speakers didn't work, connections didn't work. We're going over to BBC, like, can we plug into your whatever over here? Can you pipe us over to Tucson? I know you're worldwide, but...
And